Hello, everybody. This is Marshall Poe. I'm the founder and editor of the New Books Network. I've published several academic books, and one of the things I found frustrating is my inability to get them picked up in the press. There really is no PR service specifically oriented toward academic books. Recently, however, I had the opportunity to work with a PR firm in New York, RLM, on a book that I recently published. And I have to say, they did a remarkable job at a very low price. And this got me thinking. I wonder if the New Books Network and RLM could provide a service that would promote academic books. So the folks at RLM and I put our heads together and we came up with a package. It is specifically targeted toward people like you, people who write academic books. So if you're interested, you should go to the NBN website and click publish. Publicize your book, and there you'll find some information about the services that the NBN and RLM are offering. What we really want to do is provide you with value for money. As far as we know, no such service exists. This is the first of its kind, and we really hope it is successful, and we hope that it helps you get the word out about your academic book.
Welcome to the New Books Network.
Hello, everybody, and welcome back to New Books in Middle East Studies. I'm James Dorsey, the co-host of the channel. Today, we'll be talking to Peter Mandeville about his edited volume, Wahhabism and the World, Understanding Saudi Arabia's Global Influence on Islam. The book, to which in full disclosure, I contributed the chapter on Pakistan, constitutes one of the few, if not the first, comprehensive interrogation of the impact on the faith of Saudi financial and other support for the global spread of what Peter calls Saudi religious transnationalism, and more colloquially is referred to in the catch-all phrases as Saudi funding or support for ultra-conservatism. Interest in this goes far beyond Middle East and Islam scholars, given that much of social liberalization in Saudi Arabia, including enhanced professional and personal opportunity for women and the creation of a Western-influenced entertainment sector, has to do with social change and social political factors, and little, if anything, to do with religious reform. Peter's book has two parts. One part are contributions, including Peter's substantive introduction to the history, evolution, and the mechanics of Saudi support of religious ultra-conservatism. The other part are case studies, including Indonesia, Pakistan, Bangladesh, Central Asia, Egypt, Ethiopia, and the Sahel. Peter Mandeville, welcome to the show. We have a lot to cover in the next hour, in which I would like to focus on the Saudi side of the equation. But before we do that, let's take a few minutes to walk through your intellectual biography and the journey that took you to writing the book.
Hi, James. It's a real pleasure to be with you today and really look forward to our conversation. So this book is something that I have had in mind to produce for couple of decades, I'd say. And there's a very personal dimension to it as well, insofar as I was born and raised in Saudi Arabia myself, the third generation of my family to live and work in the kingdom as American expatriates. And so I grew up in the kingdom. And so everything that I knew about it, for the first part of my life, was information that was available to me, not available to me, living in Saudi Arabia. And it's only when I left Saudi Arabia for college, actually in my late teenage years, that I started to kind of be exposed to the way in which Saudi Arabia is perceived and talked about the wider world. And this idea that Saudi petrodollars had been funding a global operation to propagate the very conservative and austere form of Islam that is sort of indigenous to the Arabian Peninsula, what we commonly call Wahhabism, the idea that that was going on, that Saudi export of Wahhabism was an idea that I kept bumping in time and time again. I was fascinated by the discourse on Wahhabism, the way it was talked about. I noticed fairly quickly that there was a certain politics to it insofar as countries and interest groups that were to Saudi Arabia tended to emphasize the idea that Saudi Arabia was exporting religious ideas that had an enormously damaging effect on local interpretations of and practices of religion in Muslim-majority countries around the world, going often so far as to claim that the very conservative religious views propagated by Saudi Arabia were sometimes directly linked to militancy and terrorism. On the other side of the extreme of this politics, you know, you had countries and groups that were, you know, more friendly with Saudi Arabia that tended to play down this idea. You know, they would, of course, acknowledge that, you know, there was money funding religious causes, you know, but they would basically argue that, you know, this is just kind of, you know, conservative religion that's reflective of the conservative society that Saudi Arabia is, and there's no real problem with it. And, you know, my sense was that the truth was somewhere in the middle. And honestly, I didn't pay too much attention to this because I tended to emphasize, you know, being to some extent a son of the soil, as it were, someone who sort of felt a certain affinity with the kingdom as my home. I tended to downplay that narrative that said, you know, that, oh, you know, Saudi religious influence is having a huge effect around the world. But then in my own research, as I started to visit more and more Muslim communities and societies around the world, globally, elsewhere in the Middle East, in Southeast Asia, in South Asia, in Europe, in West Africa, I kept running into some version of a story where, you know, people that I was speaking with locally as part of my work would explain to me that, well, you know, we used to do Islam this way, and then at some point the Saudi money started to arrive and things began to change and religious practices and religious norms began to shift. And I kept bumping into some version of this story so frequently everywhere I went that I, you know, I became convinced that there was something that needed to be understood here. But I noticed very quickly that even though we talked about Saudi Arabia's export of Wahhabism a lot, it was a significantly understudied phenomenon. So much of the writing tended to be polemical in nature, in that it was a product of the politics around this issue that I already outlined, or you had like isolated book chapters here and there. And so I set out to try and produce the most comprehensive, academically grounded treatment of the subject that I could, and courtesy of some wonderful support for the project from the Carnegie Corporation of New York, I was able to recruit just an absolutely sterling cast of scholars, many of whom are based in the countries that they're writing about, or who have studied the aspects of the Saudi religious transnational propagation apparatus that their chapters focus on for decades. And the volume that we're going to be talking about today is the culmination of that process.
That's a great lead into basically what my first question is, which is we have this catch-all phrase of Saudi funding of religious activity, ultra-conservatism, what have you. What are we really talking about here? What were the Saudis doing or not doing?
Yeah, so when you dig into it, inevitably, it turns out to be a much more complicated phenomenon than you might imagine. I think for those who are invested in the idea that there is this Saudi export of Wahhabism, sometimes there's an image that, you know, somewhere in Riyadh, in the Saudi capital, there's like the sort of international Wahhabism command and control center where people sort of sit around in a room and make decisions about which Muslim majority country they're going to export Wahhabism to next. And there's not really anything like that going on in the sense of a centrally planned strategy around this kind of activity. And what you find as you dig into it is that there are a variety of different entities in Saudi Arabia itself that are involved in different aspects of this work. You know, you have, for example, the Saudi Ministry of Islamic Affairs and Da'wah, right? And that idea of Da'wah, of the call to religion, of, you know, the propagation of religion, you know, obviously by dint of that ministry's mission, will be involved in some of that. And so the, you know, that Saudi ministry has been involved in activities to fund mosque building and to circulate and fund textbooks and certain religious texts all around the world. You also have parastatal organizations that are strongly linked to Saudi Arabia, such as the Muslim World League and the World Assembly of Muslim Youth, neither of which are technically part of the Saudi government, but were essentially set up by the Saudis, funded primarily by the Saudis. Saudis tend to have a disproportionate level of political influence with respect to their agendas, and so they are in effect proxy entities for Saudi Arabia. And those parastatal organizations have also been involved for numerous decades now in support for a variety of religious causes around the world. You also have many small private Islamic charities based out of Saudi Arabia, a great many of which, certainly prior to 9/11, the Saudi government was not really aware of or tracking. After 9/11, when there was a broader kind of global effort to pay more attention to the transnational circulation of finance that might end up supporting terrorist or militant groups, Saudi Arabia did crack down much more and begin to regulate the charitable sector. And at that point, a great many of these small private charities either ceased operations or came more directly under government control. But prior to that, there were millions, hundreds of millions of dollars in support for religious causes leaving the kingdom through these charitable outlets that simply were not showing up on anybody's central accounting books and which the Saudi government had little to no awareness of. That all said, as much as I seem to be describing this highly decentralized system of disparate entities, organizations in the kingdom doing this work, it is fair to say that the Saudi government and the royal family in particular had some level of, let's call it sort of aggregate control in the sense of a capacity to kind of turn the spigot of religious funding on and off in ways that were tied to and aligned with Saudi Arabia's evolving geopolitical interests over time. So, for example, when this activity first started in the early 1960s, this was a time that Saudi Arabia saw its primary regional rival in Egypt under Gamal Abdel Nasser, the sort of iconic leader of the pan-Arabist movement that was so incredibly popular at that time. And King Faisal wanted to compete with and counterbalance the rather secular orientation, pan-Arabism, with religion. So when in the early 1960s, he leaned into the idea of Saudi Arabia using some of its newfound wealth to support religious causes, in political terms, that was understood as part of a strategy to compete with Egypt. As we roll forward into the 1970s and 1980s, a lot of this activity gets caught up in Cold War logic. And that's where, there's a very interesting connection to the United States. I had the opportunity when doing research for this book to talk to a number of American Cold War national security and foreign policy officials, including some within the intelligence community, who told me that that period of time, the United States absolutely welcomed Saudi Arabia's export of religion for religious causes because it was perceived by the United States as a useful way to counterbalance the sort of atheistic tendencies associated with Soviet soft power outreach. And so, the United States encouraged and in some ways indirectly supported the production and circulation of Saudi-funded religious materials, particularly to Muslim-majority countries that were viewed as potentially being at risk of communist insurrection. As we move later, past the 70s into the 80s and 90s, you know, there's another significant shift in the geopolitical utility of this work from the point of view of the Saudis. And that, of course, is tied to Iran. And in the aftermath of the 1979 Islamic Revolution in Iran, when Tehran emerges as Saudi Arabia's new kind of chief regional rival, we see a shift in the orientation and the nature of, you know, Saudi religious export activity in ways that are designed to compete with and counterbalance religious influences funded by and coming out of Tehran. So it's a complex picture, and yet one where it is possible to identify a geopolitical logic lurking behind the big picture of all of it. But, you know, what's actually quite fascinating we found is that in some cases, what we're talking about are multiple entities in Saudi Arabia involved in exporting religious influences that are actually sort of competing with each other, vying for greater influence in whatever target country they're trying to influence, meaning that sometimes the downstream manifestations of Saudi religious transnationalism are reflective of domestic political competition between different entities within the kingdom itself. So, again, a very complex and in some cases messy and chaotic picture, but one that in terms of the scale of money that has moved over the decades has absolutely had a significant effect in numerous settings around the world.
We'll get into a lot of the detail of this as we move on. But before we do that, you've opted to label this Saudi religious transnationalism rather than, for example, support of ultra-conservatism. What is it that you were trying to differentiate here by using that term?
Sure. I think that our sense as we looked into tales of the sorts of religious influences that manifest themselves in the country are on the receiving end of this religious export activity seem to vary quite widely. And in some cases, in many cases, it would indeed be very accurate to describe the content and the impact of Saudi religious influence as conservative and one that kind of tends to generate a greater emphasis on conservative interpretations of religion. That said, because one of our primary findings in doing the research was that the intended messages and religious content kind of loaded into the transnational conduit on the Saudi side often experienced significant mediation, alteration, and adaptation in the process of traveling to the country where it eventually has some manifestation or impact in ways that meant that it became increasingly difficult to find a satisfactory qualitative label to place on these religious influences. And so we therefore to kind of try to find terminology that was more neutral and simply a description of the phenomenon that is religious transnationalism emanating from Saudi Arabia, rather than trying to suggest that there was a single qualitative orientation to the nature of the religious influence that traveled through these Saudi-funded conduits.
Right. Transparency, obviously, is not something that one would call a Saudi characteristic. So walk us through some of the difficulty that's probably, you know, maybe not unique, but inherent to doing this research.
Yeah, absolutely. And it's precisely that lack of transparency which led us to ultimately not try to say anything about the So we know we're in the book, try to put forward an actual estimate in dollars with respect to how much money Saudi Arabia has devoted to this kind of religious export activity since it started in the 1960s. You will find in any number of sources, particularly journalistic sources, many different claims about, you know, how much has been spent. It is certainly a figure that is to be measured in billions. Magnitudes of billions. So we can say that much with confidence. We can also say that in recent years, the level of funding for this kind of activity has declined, but that's, you know, maybe something we'll talk about and get into a little bit later. But what's very difficult to say or to kind of achieve is any kind of meaningful accounting of it, precisely because of the lack of transparency. Now, that's not to say that there aren't some official Saudi statistics and figures. So, for example, one of the major entities that's involved in this work that I declined to mention when we were sort of talking through the different key actors on the Saudi side is the International Islamic University in Medina, which has for decades now provided many very generous scholarships that has allowed young Muslims around the world who are looking to develop careers as, you know, religious professionals, as religious scholars, come and receive their religious training in the holy city of Medina. And of course, the sort of narrative there goes that, you know, these aspiring students come to Saudi Arabia, learn this, you know, very conservative Islam that is the basis of the Saudi religious establishment, and then go back home, go back to wherever they came from, and sort of install, if you will, that kind of understanding of religion as an authoritative interpretation of Islam in that new context. And so, for example, the International Islamic University of Medina every year releases official figures about how many scholarships it has made available and, you know, which countries they come from. So, you know, you can look on their website and you'll see that in, you know, 2014 or whatever, they'll say, you know, 127 scholarships went to Malaysia and 350 scholarships went to Nigeria. And you see some of these figures laid. And you also see out of the, you know, the Ministry of Islamic Affairs and Da'wah, you'll see them in general terms talking about, you know, the number of international Islamic events that they did in any given year. These will vary from, you know, the couple hundred to several thousand. And this data just seems to express enormous swings in magnitude. And really, you know, there's no sense in which we're able to tell how accurate this is. So you know, we just don't know on that side of things. But really, where there's just a complete black hole in terms of our understanding is with respect to the enormous amount of money that has flowed out of Saudi Arabia to support religious causes via these private charities that, for, you know, for the first 30 years of their operation or more, 40 years, the state simply was not tracking them. And you know, in carrying out the research, I had the opportunity to talk to someone who was an accountant for a prominent Saudi commercial family who often would provide this kind of support in the 1970s and 80s. And he explained to me that, you know, he would receive a petitioner, for example, someone coming from a newly established Muslim community in Australia in the 1970s or 80s, and who would come and say, look, you know, we need your help. You know, we have now a significant number of Muslims, but we don't have anywhere to pray. We don't have a mosque. And so, you know, through your beneficence, through your generosity, you could make it possible for the Muslims of Australia to, you know, have a place of worship. You know, and as the accountant told me, you know, the sort of patriarch of the commercial family would, you know, summon him and get out the checkbook and just write a check for significant amounts of money that would be handed to the petitioner of Australia, who would then go off, and no one ever really followed up to see what happened. And so, you know, not only was this money not the outflows, you know, not necessarily being tracked, in some cases, you know, there was no follow-up in order to find out how the money actually ended up being used. So there's just a lot that we don't know about this phenomenon by dint of some of the practices that tended to be fairly standard around the loose flow of finance in and out of the kingdom.
It strikes me that, you know, you referred to this, that there was really a lack of oversight, certainly prior to 9/11. And it strikes me that what you saw was that various organizations, including peristatals, were run by almost by political trends. Certain organizations had a very strong Muslim Brotherhood influence. Other organizations had a more jihadist influence. Some of their, you know, branches were sanctioned. In fact, led to the, in some cases, to the dissolution of those organizations. You know, that lack of oversight, but this goes back to one of your original remarks, which was there was no central Supreme Committee running this, which I think is true, but you could also argue that that there was an environment. There was a core, very well-funded governmental and governmental, non-governmental, if you wish, effort. But there was also, and you saw that a lot in Mecca, that you had these operatives of foreign groups, some of them violent, some of them very militant, who were able to more or less freely raise funds for their specific causes. So the question is really, you know, yes, you didn't have a central committee directing this, but in a sense you had a concerted effort.
There was absolutely concerted effort in the sense that some of the personnel working in the various Saudi groups and organizations that were involved in this work had certain political and in some cases militant agendas that were being funded from out of this work. And it was also known by certain militant groups in some settings that it was possible to receive funding from these Saudi groups, particularly the private charities, right? So it is absolutely the case that out of the private charities, significant amounts of funding to support groups like Hamas has flowed, and certainly support for groups, the entire ecosystem of militant jihadi groups in South Asia have absolutely been supported, as your own contribution to the book, James, makes very clear. So just to kind of touch in a little bit more detail on a couple of the points you've raised, because this kind of phenomenon of an effort tied to a variety of different political agendas is also part of the reason that we wanted to move away from simply calling this the export of Wahhabism, because sometimes it wasn't the specific religious ideas of Salafism or Wahhabism that were being transmitted through these conduits, but rather they were being used, co-opted in some cases by specific groups that managed to secure professional roles and functionary positions for themselves within these organizations. So just a couple of brief examples to kind of give some more specific texture to that broad point. One of the major international Islamic charities operating out of Saudi Arabia during the sort of heyday of this stuff, and, you know, I date that kind of from the 70s through the 90s, is the International Islamic Relief Organization, IIRO. 95% of whose activity constitutes very important and highly valuable humanitarian relief. However, there were particular bureaus and divisions within IIRO that were managed by individuals who had ties to and were sympathetic to militant groups in specific contexts, whereby some of the funding that flowed through IIRO channels ended up being diverted to those groups. And so you will find, if you look at, you know, U.S. government treasury lists that, you know, that detail specific organizations that have been designated or sanctioned in particular ways, you'll find periods of time when particular divisions of the IIRO are viewed by the U.S. government as problematic, not the organization as a whole, right? But very specific divisions where there is known to be this kind of diversion of funds for other kinds of causes. You mentioned the Muslim Brotherhood as well. And to me, this is one of the most fascinating aspects of the story to come out, just because, you know, right now we tend to think of Saudi Arabia as being a key member of a regional axis of states in the Middle East that are opposed to the Brotherhood and working actively to negate the Ikhwan, the Muslim Brotherhood, as a social and political force across the Middle East. You know, turn back the clock 40 years, and we find a very different orientation on the part of the Saudis towards the Muslim Brotherhood. The 1970s and 80s, Brotherhood figures, particularly exiles from Egypt, were welcomed with open arms in Saudi Arabia and given jobs at Saudi universities and also given jobs within the parastatal organizations that we touched on earlier, such as the Muslim World League and the World Assembly of Muslim Youth. Indeed, I don't think it's an exaggeration to say that there were periods of time in the 1980s when the sort of rank and file of mid to upper level management within those organizations were not people whose religious orientation would best be described as Wahhabism, but rather those organizations were being managed by supporters of the Muslim Brotherhood, meaning then that they had the opportunity to use these Saudi-funded parastatal organizations in order to advance their, you know, sort of transnational Muslim Brotherhood type agenda. And that's why, you know, for us, it was important to make clear that this idea of this enormous and well-funded apparatus being used exclusively to export an understanding of Islam that was specific to Saudi Arabia simply isn't accurate. It was a vast infrastructure that was available for use by adherence to a wide range of ideologies and political agendas. And I think that sort of diversity in terms of its socio-political valence is vitally important to understand in order to actually assess the nature and impact of the broader phenomenon.
Just staying on this point for a minute, it strikes me that another way of describing this schematically, if you wish, is that the ruling family as such had geopolitical objectives. And the religious content didn't really matter that much to them as long as it served that religious or that geopolitical purpose. It may have mattered more to the religious establishment, although it was willing to make the compromises it needed to make to maintain its arrangement with the ruling family. And so that may also be the explanation why, indeed, it was not export of Wahhabism in the narrow sense of the word, but much more that religious ultra-conservatism that certainly post-1979 was anti-Shiite, anti-Iranian.
Yes, absolutely. I would say though that I am hesitant to reduce the phenomenon entirely to political instrumentalism. In that, I would say, James, that basically I agree with you in the sense that I don't think there were many senior members of the royal family who took a particularly close look at the ideological content that was flowing to make sure that it was consistent with particular religious commitments they had. I think by and large, so long as the impact of it was consistent with their interests and needs, they didn't really care too much about the specifics of the content. That said, particularly when it first started, I talked about its origins primarily in relation to Saudi Arabia's geopolitical needs vis-a-vis Egypt in the 1960s. That factor was certainly present, but I also think there was a genuine sense on the part of the Saudi royal family that as the leaders of the country that is sort of, geospiritually, if I could put it that way, ground zero in terms of Islam, that they had a particular obligation to support religious causes around the world. So I do think that there is some element of that. And I certainly think that as this stuff played out over the years, part of the ability to just kind of turn a blind eye to it on the part of senior Saudi leadership was tied up with them being able to simply tell themselves, we're just supporting religious causes around the world, as is our obligation. And then you can start to kind of zoom down and look in a little bit more detail about the ways in which specific members of the Saudi royal family took a particular interest in religious export activity vis-a-vis certain goals politically, regionally, globally that they had. And that's certainly the case with respect to the current Crown Prince Mohammed bin Salman, who I assume we'll have the opportunity to touch on a little later.
Yeah.
Eat stress-free this spring with Factor's delicious ready-to-eat meals. Every fresh, never-frozen meal is chef-crafted, dietitian-approved, and ready to eat in just 2 minutes. Choose from a weekly menu of 35 options, including popular options like Calorie Smart, Keto, Protein Plus, or Vegan and Veggie. Get chef-prepared meals on the table in 2 minutes with Factor's ready-to-eat meals, so you can go back to doing what you love this spring. Looking for gourmet meals? Try meals that feature premium ingredients like filet mignon, shrimp, truffle butter, broccolini, and asparagus. And this is the part I really like. No fuss, no mess meals. Factor meals eliminate the hassle of prepping, cooking, or cleaning. You simply heat and savor the good stuff. Factor's the solution for fast, premium meals without the need for cooking. Head to factormeals.com/NBN50 and use code NBN50 to get 50% off your first box plus 20% off your next box. That's code NBN50 at factormeals.com/NBN50 to get 50% off your first box plus 20% off your next box while your subscription is active.
No, I want to get to him shortly. But before we do that, talking about this whole ecosphere, if you wish, of Saudi support for religious activity, one factor in that is migrant labor, both in terms of remittances, but also in terms of the experience of having lived in an austere, religiously austere kingdom and returning back to their homelands after X number of years. Can you talk to us a little bit about that?
Yeah, absolutely. And this is a dimension of the phenomenon that was of particular interest to me and that we wanted to look at in some detail in the book. And in fact, we do, insofar as there's a chapter in the book authored by Professor Nazli Kibria, which is a case study of Bangladesh, but it's specifically looking at the extent to which labor migrant dynamics provided a channel through which religious influences might flow from Saudi Arabia to Bangladesh as migrant laborers who had spent often a significant amount of time in the kingdom would go back home, carrying with them certain kinds of religious ideas that they'd been exposed to, but also with money, right? They were making, relatively speaking, a fair amount of cash. That's why those jobs were viewed as so lucrative. Some of them also maintained relations with Saudi benefactors that allowed additional resources to flow back. And so one aspect of this whole issue that had been often discussed and kind of speculated about was the idea that because you have in Saudi Arabia so many migrant laborers coming from certainly countries in the Middle East, but also Muslim majority settings in South and Southeast Asia, places like Bangladesh, like Pakistan, like Indonesia, countries like India that obviously have an enormous Muslim minority population, that those returning labor migrants might not just be sending financial remittances home, but in Nazlı Kıbrıya's wonderfully evocative term in her title, you know, are they also sending religious remittances home? And so she kind of takes a look at that in the case of Bangladesh, looking primarily at the Bangladeshi province of Sylhet, which is the source of the majority of labor migration to the GCC countries. And, you know, she finds a rather uneven picture there. You know, there is certainly some evidence that, you know, there in some cases were individuals that came back from spending several decades in the Gulf who basically arrived back home and said, look, you know, I've been to Saudi Arabia, I've been to Mecca and Medina, I've been to the heartland, as it were, of the religion, you know, the place where you have authentic Islam, and I've realized that we're doing it all wrong. And so now I'm back here with money to set up to build mosques, but we're going to make sure that there are certain kinds of imams in those mosques, and there's certain kinds of books and teachings that are flowing through those mosques. So to some extent, that certainly was going on. But there, you know, she found evidence of other cases where individuals came back and with some level of relief actually integrated back into the often kind of more Sufi inspired and based set of local religious practices in their community. One thing that's worth bearing in mind in terms of understanding that labor migrant conduit for spreading religious influence is actually related to the changing political economy of labor migration to the Gulf. You know, in the 70s and 80s, it used to be fairly common that an individual would, you know, through a contracting organization, come to work in Saudi Arabia or Kuwait or a country like that, and they would be able to make a career for themselves of several decades, and often sort of, you know, living in, you know, living out in the kind of local economy, fairly well integrated, and with much more opportunity to build relationships with and have direct exposure to other Saudis. And I think it's that multi-generational career model that is likely most heavily related to the capacity to transmit significant levels of religious influence back to a homeland when a labor migrant, you know, eventually returns, often in retirement. In more recent years, those labor migrant gigs have become much more short-term in nature. They're structured in ways that someone's existence and livelihood in somewhere like Saudi Arabia, where they're often confined in, you know, as we know, very challenging conditions, you know, to what are effectively contract labor camps, you know, their ability to build relationships and connect with Saudis, be exposed to certain kinds of ideas, is significantly more limited. So my sense is that over time, that labor migration transmission dimension has become a less significant aspect of the broader phenomenon of Saudi religious transnational.
Before we jump to Mohammed bin Salman, I want to focus just a little bit on what obviously is in lots of people's minds, which is the relationship between Saudi Arabian religious conservatism and violence. And that's a very complex relationship. You've identified two mechanisms that you say are key to this. One, the denationalization and recontextualization of Wahhabism, and the promotion of what you called exclusionary identities and depluralization of religious culture. Walk us through what you mean by these terms and by these developments.
So when I talk about the sort of denationalized impact of Wahhabism. And Wahhabism is a term that I think we can understand as a distinctly Saudi variant of the broader theological orientation in modern Islam called Salafism. And so what I mean by this is that one impact that it often has is to focus on the emphasis of a Muslim identity above and beyond other kinds of local, provincial, or national identities. And in the realm of religion, it's a theological orientation that is puritanical in the sense that it rejects the idea that there are different legitimate schools of thought in Islam. So in mainstream Sunni Islam, for centuries, you know, the standard when it comes to Islamic law, jurisprudential orientation is to say that there are four recognized orthodox schools of Islamic law. And they have different emphases and they have different origins and histories and different methodologies associated with them. But, you know, they're widely accepted and valid. Salafism rejects this idea, right? The basis of Salafism is to say, look, there are no alternative schools of legal thought. There is Islam. You're either doing Islam correctly or you're not. It's not that there are these different options, and certainly these sorts of practices, such as the broadly prevalent throughout the Muslim world, beliefs and practices associated with Sufism, so Islamic mysticism, you know, are rejected outright. And so one of the impacts of the Saudi Arabia's transmission of these ideas has been to, in some cases, to weaken an individual or a community's ties to those, you know, strong, locally rooted interpretations of religion in ways that sort of has the effect of kind of pulling them out of their community to some extent, and then I think making it possible for them to more easily gravitate towards politicized understandings of religion that are focused on the need to serve and promote global Islamic causes. And this is precisely the kind of discourse that Salafi jihadi groups like Al-Qaeda and ISIS have sought to tap into. Another kind of clear area where there's a relationship between Saudi religious influence, conflict, and in some cases violence has to do with intercommunal relations. So one of the religious orientations within the influences coming out of Saudi Arabia has been its virulently anti-Shia or orientation. And in the case of some Saudi religious scholars, their view is not simply that Shiism is wrong or that Shia are not really Muslims. It doesn't stop there. Some of them will go so far as to say that Shia are effectively apostates. And therefore should be killed under Islamic law. And so what I think has happened in some cases, particularly in parts of South Asia, where you do have significant Shia minority communities in some Muslim majority populations, is that when Saudi religious influences enter a social context in which there is a pre-existing form of intercommunal tension that falls out along sectarian lines, the arrival of that Saudi influence, you know, acts as a catalyst and an accelerant that increases and sharpens that tension in ways that can sometimes tip into open conflict and even violence in some cases.
Obviously, Saudi Arabia today, under the Salman since 2015, is attempting to project a very different image, and one of moderation, of openness. Walk us through what has changed and what has not changed, and what is religious about this and what is not, what is being presented as religious change, but really may be much more social change.
Yeah, no. I mean, these kinds of transformations that we've been seeing and hearing about vis-a-vis Saudi Arabia and religion in Saudi Arabia are just fascinating. You know, some of it has folks like me that have been, you know, observing the religious dynamics in and around the kingdom for decades. It really kind of has our heads spinning. Intriguingly, a few years back, you know, Saudi Crown Prince Mohammed bin Salman announced that he was planning to, as he put it, return Saudi Arabia to moderate Islam. You know, and this gave a number of us pause because, you know, we're very curious to know, like, what did he mean by that? I mean, is he saying that there was a time when religion in Saudi Arabia was moderate and then something happened to make it immoderate or extreme? And he wants to kind of roll that back. What exactly was going on with that, you know, enormously intriguing statement? And as we heard him say more about it, my sense is that what he meant primarily by moderate Islam is apolitical Islam. Interpretations of religion and religious practices that don't have attached to them any kind of political ideology or political agenda. And so, you know, when talking about this, he did put some dating on it. And he said, you know, this is, he wants to, you know, go back before 1979, you know, and 1979, which is a sort of watershed year for anyone who studies political Islam, because we had everything from the Soviet invasion of Afghanistan, the Islamic revolution in Iran, but we also had, and many, I think, forget this key moment, we had the 1979 seizure of the Grand Mosque in Mecca, which was in many ways the first manifestation of organized, violent Islamist opposition to the Saudi royal family, where a group that had kind of cross-fertilized the political, militant, ideological agenda of figures like the Egyptian Muslim Brotherhood ideologue Said Qutb, cross-fertilized those ideas with the local Saudi religious orientation, you know, that we've called Wahhabism, you know, through, by the way, being exposed to, you know, militant Muslim Brotherhood ideas being taught by Egyptian political exiles that had been brought into Saudi Arabia, as we discussed previously. It created this sort of hybrid Wahhabi militant Ikhwan construct that it is vitally important because it is the basis, eventually, I think it's fair to say, of the movements that we know today as Al-Qaeda and ISIS. And so when Crown Prince Mohammed bin Salman talks about returning to moderate Islam, I think he means depoliticizing Islam as much as possible. So that's consistent with the idea of cracking down on the Muslim Brotherhood and any other groups and movements that have a politicized understanding of their religion. I think Mohammed bin Salman's public relations operatives, certainly those in Washington, D.C., you know, sought to spin this as the idea that the Crown Prince was committed to a more sort of tolerant and open, flexible, pluralistic understanding of religion. And then, you know, would try to link that to other things that he seemed to be doing, such as, for example, cracking down on the country's religious establishment, and particularly the Mutawwa, the Committee of Vice and Virtue, excuse me, who for decades had been involved in, you know, being active on the streets of Saudi Arabia, looking out for people engaging in behaviors that they understood to be inconsistent with their understanding of religion and meting out punishments accordingly. One of the things that Mohammed bin Salman has done is to severely curb the capacity of the religious police, effectively pulling them off the streets entirely in most Saudi cities. He has also worked through some of the parastatal organizations that we, you know, talked about previously. The Muslim World League, for example, he handpicked and put at the top of the Muslim World League Sheikh Mohammed Al-Isa, a former minister of justice in Saudi Arabia, and charged him with kind of taking the Muslim World League in a different kind of direction. And so indeed, what you found suddenly was the Muslim World League sponsoring activities focused on the need for interfaith dialogue and increased tolerance between people of different faiths. The Muslim World League started sponsoring events and conferences focused on the dangers of anti-Semitism, right? And this is the kind of stuff that had people like me, it's a head spinning, just because, you know, 30 years previously, the Muslim World League was an organization that would be identified with the propagation of anti-Semitism rather than trying to do something about it. You know, and so you had like Sheikh Mohammed Al-Isa, you know, visited Auschwitz, and, you know, just in recent days has been hosting in Saudi Arabia a conference focused on trying to find a set of common values, being followers of different faiths. So there's a lot of this kind of, you know, symmetry and many declarations of pluralism and tolerance coming out. And it's, you know, attempting to send a very different kind of message. That all said, you know, I still see at the core of it a certain kind of political agenda, and one that I think is consistent with Mohammed bin Salman's interests. I think the curbing of the influence of the religious establishment, taking the religious police off the streets in Saudi Arabia, doesn't tell us much about Mohammed bin Salman's preference for a more flexible and tolerant interpretation of Islam, as it tells us about his need to consolidate political power and make sure that there are no threats to the very centralized model of political authority and leadership that he wants to operate under, right? It's to basically say, yes, there will be reform, but it will be reform on my terms and on my timeline. And if you try to get too far ahead of me with it, there will be consequences, right? And so this is consistent with, for example, the ways in which he lifts legally the ban on women driving. And then the next week, several of the women activists that were part of that movement are detained and thrown in jail, right? It's yes, things will change, but they will change on my terms. With respect to the stuff about religious tolerance, I just think that it's important for Saudi Arabia right now to project a certain kind of persona with respect to its role in countering extremism and countering politicized interpretations of religion. And so these parastatal organizations, figures like Sheikh Mohammed Al-Isa, you know, are part and parcel of that. My slightly more cynical question about, for example, the Muslim World League's work on anti-Semitism is to say, look, it's wonderful that those messages are coming out. These are important things to be saying. There absolutely are major problems with anti-Semitism in the world today. So glad you're working on that. But beyond having a conference and issuing some statements, are the regional and country offices of the Muslim World League now actually engaging in educational and programmatic activities focused on addressing anti-Semitism as it manifests itself in societies and communities where the MWL, the Muslim World League, is working? In other words, are they actually walking the talk? At the end of the day, I think Mohammed bin Salman is a pragmatist in the sense that I don't think he has any particular ideological commitment one way or another with respect to Wahhabism. He has a vision for the kingdom, and I think that when conservative religion or when Wahhabism is an impediment to fulfilling that vision, he will clamp down on it, crack down on it. Conversely, if there are times when promoting Wahhabism or certain interpretations of Islam are conducive to his broader agenda, I don't think he'll hesitate to use that tool. And we continue to have some evidence that, you know, alongside this broad orientation of, you know, making religion more moderate, there are a few channels through which fairly conservative, hardline religious views are not only kind of tolerated, but encouraged. And this is with respect to Iran and Saudi Arabia's ongoing rivalry with Iran, where, you know, even today, religious scholars associated with the Saudi religious establishment are very active in spreading and promoting anti-Shia views. And in, you know, in their mind, Shiism equals Iran. So I think, you know, even, you know, there is, with respect to Mohammed bin Salman, one area in which we continue to see him making use of Saudi religious transnationalism as an instrument of statecraft.
I would love to follow up on some of this. In fact, maybe even tackle you on some of this. But I see the clock ticking, unfortunately. The one thing I'll throw at you before we come to a conclusion is it strikes me that in many ways, you used the word apolitical. It strikes me, in fact, that it's very political, because it's the religious concept that's being put forward is the concept of absolute obedience to the ruler. Yes. And that is political.
You're absolutely right. I mean, in a sense, what he's trying to do is to make sure that all teaching vis-a-vis Islam in Saudi Arabia is consistent with a certain orientation that has always been present within the Saudi religious establishment, which you know, which fuses, you know, highly conservative religion with a doctrine of absolute loyalty to the crown. And so you're absolutely right that it's deeply political in that it's about saying, hey, you don't ask questions about how the country is run. You just focus on being a devout, good Muslim and get on with your life, and the royal family will provide for the rest. And that obviously is political. So when I talk about it as being apolitical in nature, I meant he's pushing back against any interpretation of religion that has associated with it a transformative political ideology that suggests that the prevailing status quo should be upset. But your correction there is an important and vital one.
Thank you. We've only touched on the surface of this and could go on for hours. In fact, I think I've only posed about a third of the questions I had prepared for you. But unfortunately, we are hitting the clock. But before I let you go, tell me a little bit about what you're doing next, what your next project or projects are.
Sure. So this book on Wahhabism was part of a broader project, again, supported by the Carnegie Corporation of New York, called The Geopolitics of Religious Soft Power. And it started life with a focus on comparing the ways in which religion has been used as an instrument of statecraft, of, you know, in the foreign policies of countries like Saudi Arabia, obviously, but also Iran and Turkey. And as that project has evolved, however, it's just become increasingly clear that the kind of use of religion as a geopolitical tool, if I can put it that way, is something that is found in a wide range of countries, not just the Muslim world, not just the Middle East. And so that project has just been renewed for another few years of activity. And in its second phase, we'll be focusing much more on the use of religion as an instrument of statecraft by emerging powers. So a lot of focus on Russia and the very specific partnership that has sprung up over the last couple of decades between the Kremlin and the Moscow Patriarchate of the Russian Orthodox Church. We'll be looking at China in that regard, India, Brazil. There's just a whole wide world of what we call religious soft power and its geopolitics to be explored. So that's what I'll be focusing on over the next few years.
Peter, that sounds like a great project. Thank you for being on the show today. I really enjoyed it. Wish you all the best and take care.
Thanks so much, James. I really appreciated the opportunity to speak to you today.